This week on The Futurists, Kim Stanley Robinson.
This whole science fiction exercise of terraforming, you know, other planets. A, we can only get to Mars and Venus in any practical sense. B, Earth is in terrible trouble, and could the ecosystem could crash in a way that would crash civilization with it.
Welcome back to The Futurists, friends. I'm your host, Brett King. And since I started this podcast, I've had a goal or an objective. There's one guest that I really wanted to get on the show. And that is because a lot of the problems that we talk about on the show, the impact of artificial intelligence, the shift around climate, what that's going to mean for the planet, there's one science fiction author living today who has done an incredible job in modeling that future of our world. He's considered by many to be the greatest living science fiction author today in respect to this area of climate change and climate response specifically. But also, he wrote an incredible trilogy on the future of colonization of Mars, a three-book series, the Mars Trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. And that series was written over almost a decade, and we're going to get into it today on the show with him. But each of these moments sort of that we're seeing today, the SpaceX program, Starship program, potentially taking us to Mars, how climate is unfolding and how we're, you know, starting to see, you know, the Greenland and West Antarctic ice shelves at threat and, you know, the climbing temperatures and that affecting, you know, arable land and farming and so forth. All of this stuff he's modeled out in various ways through his series of science fiction books. So it's, really a great fabric from which to continue this radio show or this podcast in respect to how we solve some of these problems of the future. And when it comes to this area, I would like to think that this is sort of the ultimate guest for us to have on the show, or the ultimate type of guest. We also get into his future of economics thinking, how that might work, and sort of how geopolitics might evolve somewhat as well. This is a two-part series. We're going to play the second part of his interview next week. But I just wanted to share some of the, my thoughts as we go into this interview. At the end of the interview, I'll give you some thoughts in terms of each of the sections and some of the truths and some of the opinions that Stan delivers to us. But it was a personal highlight for me to have Stan join us on the show, and he did not disappoint. He's an incredible author and a incredible philosopher and thinker when it comes to the future of humanity. And I think we're all going to be a little bit smarter for having listened to his insights on the show. Welcome to this week's Futurist with Kim Stanley Robinson. Welcome to The Futurists. I am your host, Brett King, and joining me today in the hosting chair is Rob Tursek. Hey, howdy. Rob.
Good to see you.
And Miss Metaverse.
Hey, Kate. Hey, happy to be back.
Yeah, well, this is one that, as you guys know, I've been a big fan of this author's work, and we've been hoping to get him on for a while, and very fortunately, with an introduction to David Brin, we've made it happen. Many of you will know this author because we've talked about a lot of his work on the show, particularly in respect to things like colonization of Mars and so forth, and he's an American writer of science fiction. In fact, The New Yorker says he's generally acknowledged as one of the greatest living science fiction writers. His name is Kim Stanley Robinson. Stan, welcome to The Futurists.
And thanks, you guys. It's good to be with you.
Where are you coming to us from today?
I am in Davis, California, where I live, a little town, college town, about 10 miles west of Sacramento.
Awesome. Well, you know, first of all, I think why don't we get started with, you know, how you, you know, when it was that you decided that you wanted to be a science fiction author? When did you have that epiphany, or did it just happen organically?
Well, there was a kind of an epiphany. I was a reader as a kid, and through high school, I was a reader of detective stories. And I didn't really know about science fiction. And right at the end of my high school career, I ran into the science fiction section of my library and began to read it. And it seemed right to me. I had grown up in Orange County, California, when it was agricultural and it got turned into city through my childhood and youth. I saw that process. And when I started reading science fiction, I said to myself, this feels right. This is an actual realism. At least a realism of feelings. And I started to read science fiction intensively. And I got a lot of help, I have to say, from my literature department professors at UC San Diego. And they sent me up to an English professor at Cal State Fullerton, close to where I grew up, Willis McNally. He was a science fiction expert. This was just like 1970 or 71. But they were encouraging. They said, if you're into it, go for it. And introduced me to Harlan Ellison, who gave me the address for the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop. And I thought, I had been writing poetry, and that wasn't going spectacularly well, but it was fun to try. And with this Clarion address, I wrote off and said I'd like to join. And I had one science fiction short story. I sent it off to Clarion. And they accepted me, but I couldn't go that summer. I was working. I had girlfriend issues. And I said, sorry, I can't come this summer. They showed that story to Damon Knight. And when I was driving across the United States on Highway 80 from Northern California to Boston to go to graduate school, I called home to my mom. And she said, there's a letter here from Damon Knight. And I said, open it and read it. And it said, I like your Clarion submission story. Can I buy it for Orbit, the anthology that he ran at the time? And so I drove up to the highest point on Highway 80, where there's a giant statue of the head of Abraham Lincoln. And I slept in the parking lot, as I was doing in those days, next to my car. And I would say that night, under Lincoln's head, a space I visited just last year for the first time and in between, I said, well, I want to do this. And so science fiction became my cause at that point, my project. And I've focused on it ever since that day, which I guess would have been sometime in late August of 1974.
Interesting. Now, you
moment of epiphany.
Yeah. It's interesting because you have described, and I know Rob wants to talk about this as well, you have described how various places and environments have stimulated your ideas and your writing. Of course, one of the themes that you are known for these days, not just from your most recent work, but even your first trilogy, the Orange County trilogy or the Three Californias trilogy, that even right back then, in 84, I think it was when you started that, had a very strong sort of climate and environmental message to it. So was the science fiction a vehicle for that, or was that just something that to you sort of came naturally as part of the writing?
I think it's more the latter, but I've been pondering that question. And what I think happened was when I fell in love with science fiction and read it intensively, so I'm reading, say, the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, I noticed that it was kind of an urban literature. The spaceship is a city. There's Asimov's Trantor. It was mostly guys. It was mostly urban guys. And so it was apartment literature, or they knew urban spaces. There wasn't much in the way of landscapes or settings. Now, that wasn't entirely true. There was Clifford Simak in the backwoods of Wisconsin, Edgar Pangborn in the backwoods of Connecticut. And then also, very importantly, Jack Vance, his planetary romances, Seeing Places, and then Ursula Le Guin in her first four novels,
right,
which blew my mind. They were all planetary romances. They were place novels. And, you know, it's not that it was a California thing. It was specific people who were, in literary terms, you could say they were aware that setting is important, that it's another character of sorts, and that it impacts all the other characters in it, and it gives a mood or a spaciousness to the narrative, that the humans are in a backdrop against their, not just their landscape, but in science fictional terms, their planet. Well, that, there I thought I could bring something, because I'd spent a lot of time in the beaches, and already when I began writing science fiction, I had spent a fair bit of time in the Sierra Nevada. So I thought, well, something new I could bring to science fiction is the, not quite new, but relatively new, is this angle of landscapes, of settings, of the planet being part of the story, like a crucial part of the story. By the time I got to the Mars trilogy, of course, that was the main method that I was using. But even from the very start in my three California novels, there were three different Southern Californias because of the historical and climactic fates that I cast the three different futures into. So it was something I was paying attention from the start, partly just because it's what I knew, partly because I thought it was a new literary effect or something that could make me distinctive in the crowd of science fiction writers, that I would join that small group that I just mentioned and be that kind of a science fiction writer that was attentive to place.
You know, one of the things that I noticed is that your approach to this subject, this topic, is a little different from writers who went before you. And what I'm zeroing in on is that, you know, when you say you make the environment a character in the story, sometimes it's the protagonist, sometimes it's an antagonist. You know, it's actually defeating or rendering futile the efforts of civilization. And I think that's novel, right? If you think about things that came before, like Dune or Asimov's Foundation series, here mankind's always dominant, and it's like they're always acting on the environment. What I've taken from some of your work is, that doesn't always work so well for humanity. You know, humanity's always struggling, striving to establish civilization, and then the planet's going to do its own thing. You cannot control it. You can't dominate it. How much of that comes from your own experience? Say, for instance, you know, you've written extensively about hiking in the mountains in the Sierra Nevadas. How much of that comes from your experience there?
A lot of it does. There's a very powerful feeling that comes from walking every day. And having just your entire household carried on your back. This is primeval. It's some kind of Paleolithic feeling. And our brains grew from a third of the size they are now to the size they are now, pursuing that activity. So when you pursue that activity, all those parts of your brain that grew doing it, they begin to hum, and in ways that don't happen when you live in rooms. So it makes you aware in a very deep level, and a kind of underbed of everything that you think with your conscious mind has got an extra hum to it from following that activity. And I'm trying to write that down as hard. Now, but I'm glad, Rob, that you mentioned Dune, because really Dune was transformative. I read it on a trip through Canada in 71, a little late compared to its publication date, but it was becoming famous. Mm-hmm. And there, those people are coping with that planet and doing what they can with the tech that they have. And the planet rules. You can't change Dune. They're not terraforming Dune. They're existing there. And it's an ecological novel. And Herbert famously did studies on sand dunes and how to calm them down with grass, et cetera. This was news to me. And again, I read that about 71. And was a, I've since reread Dune, and it seems to be that Herbert was actually teaching himself how to write novels whilst he wrote Dune. It was a long process. Mm-hmm. It begins clunky and with the villains that twirl their mustaches and is basically unimpressive as hell on the human level. And the story kind of lifted from the story of Muhammad, et cetera, et cetera. But as that novel goes on, it gathers strength and momentum, and it's partly the planet itself becoming such a vibrant protagonist or thing that everybody has to cope with. And so I didn't love that book the way I love Le Guin, and this has to do with personalities and characters and style, but I admired it hugely, and it had a big impact on me.
And many others, of course, right? Including George Lucas, right? In the whole Star Wars.
Yeah. So, indeed, yes.
It's also interesting that Kevin J. Anderson, who now is heavily involved in the Dune universe, who I'm sure you know, Stan, he does a lot of his writing hiking as well. You know, he actually dictates into a voice recorder, which we've interviewed him on the show about that. I still find that amazing, but very, very interesting. But you reportedly in an interview at UCSD said you got one of the ideas that stimulated the Mars trilogy for you was that you saw a satellite photo of Mars and you thought, I'd love to go hiking there. Is that true?
Oh, yes. The Viking data were mind-boggling because before Mariner and Viking, we knew next to nothing about Mars. And then when we got the photos, both on the ground, but especially the satellite photos, NASA put out a book of photos from the Viking orbiter that included some that had stereo opticon visions and a little device at the back you could put on the page and look through both lenses, and it would pop to 3D. And the specific moment where it popped to 3D, and it was one cliff crossing another at almost right angles in a way that I don't think its equivalent exists on Earth. And I thought that would be an amazing thing to see. And in general, although I was deceived in many ways at that moment, I thought that would be a great place to go backpacking. And this was around 1980. And so at that point, my whole Mars project began to develop in my mind. I wrote a short story to test it out. I wrote a novella to grab the title Green Mars, which I thought was hanging fruit that was too obvious. Someone else was going to use it before I got to it. And so I slowly built up to the writing of the Mars trilogy. And it was based on this apprehension that it would be a great place to wander the surface, which I still think is quite true. Although now we know the surface is intensely poisonous, which we didn't know back then.
Yeah.
Tell us about your methodology. When you do research for a book, we're keen to understand that. And our listeners like to hear about futurist methodologies in general. But it's quite clear when you read your books, there's an enormous amount of research going on. So it's not just about staring at a map and imagining. You dig much deeper. Tell us a little bit about your process for preparing for a novel.
Well, I read a lot. I like to read. I like to be comprehensive in my reading and also random in my reading. And so as an ordinary reader or an intensive reader in love with reading, I like being random. I'll pick up a book and I think, gee, I wonder what this is. I like to read. And I love that feeling of randomness because I was probably a student for way too long. And I don't like people telling me what to read anymore. But when I get a project, then suddenly my reading gets organized. And then with Mars, I was lucky. It was the high point of the Viking generation of Mars planetologists. They were excited. They had new data that had never been seen before. They were analyzing it and postulating about it. And there's no coincidence that the early terraforming thinking and Mars study came about at the same time, because Mars turns out to be looked like at then in 1980 a perfect candidate for terraforming within human powers to turn it into a kind of a garden planet just on the edge of the zone of habitability. Got some frozen water, got a lot of volatiles. All you have to do is heat that planet up and introduce some Terran DNA, and bam, you've got the high Arctic. This was the thought at the time. And so I ran into those people and I introduced myself to one of the most prominent and best of them, Christopher McKay, NASA scientist working down at NASA Ames in Mountain
great
View,
guy.
California.
Yeah,
great guy. And only about 100 miles from me. And he immediately became my tech support and has been ever since. When I need to have a planetologist answer a question, I'll email Chris. He'll answer, and I always find it helpful. He's a wonderful teacher. He's extremely clear and persuasive. He's a good writer, So that was how I did it. And the one thing I want to add to that is that it took me about 7 years to write the Mars trilogy. That now looks really fast to me. And I'm not sure how I did it. But the thing is, I was researching the whole time. So there's stuff in Blue Mars that I did not know when I wrote Red Mars.
Yeah.
And that's good. It means Blue Mars looks like it has plot surprises. It looks like I'm going to save this information. In fact, I didn't know it at all. And I found it out late in the game of writing. And so it was actually a help to the novel rather than a hindrance.
We don't always know that. It seems like you have all the answers at your disposal. So frankly,
I was going to say the same. You know, like you seem like an expert on geology.
Exactly.
You delve into longevity, you know, not only, you know, looking at establishing a colony, but just the idea of the first 100, you know, and their different applications and so forth. It's so well-rounded in terms of sort of thinking about all of those issues. But of course, we've learned more about Mars, you know, since you wrote that trilogy. And sort of this sort of brings me to the fact that a couple of times you've had very close attempts at adapting this to film or to TV. But maybe the better way to ask you the question is, if you wrote the Mars trilogy today, how would it be different?
Oh, God. Well, luckily, that is a hypothetical, because I don't want to change a word of that trilogy. It's solid like a boulder. It has its own integrity. There are things in it that we now know are wrong. The main thing that is problematic, let's put it, is that we've discovered since I wrote the book that there are perchlorates in the soil. Perchlorates, I don't know how to pronounce it, but I do know that it's highly poisonous to humans. So we use it in the parts per billion to dampen our thyroids. If you've got hyperthyroidism, it's a medicine, it's a poison. It's in the parts per hundred in Martian sand. And so you would have to hydrate the entire surface of Mars, and that would quickly detoxify the planetary surface. But there you've got a kind of chicken and egg problem. How do you hydrate the entire surface of Mars? It's not practical. So that's the one finding that has happened since my book came out that sort of turns my book into a bit of a fantasy. And I like science fiction more than I like fantasy. So I'm discouraged at that. But there's also the possibility that there's still life living in the regolith on Mars. A very remote possibility, my expert friends tell me, but it's not entirely off the table. So that too is a complication. And then also the geopolitical situation. I was thinking about this after I read your questions. I have an American-Russian team go up there because these are two fading powers who have space programs. They're trying to stave off the tigers of Hong Kong and Taiwan and Vietnam, the East Asian tiger economies. Well, all of that is perfectly accurate to 1990, but it didn't turn out that way. And here we are now in 2024. You can see that it is a work of its moment. And if you were to write it now, the obvious thing to do would be to talk about America and China cooperating and maybe try to draw the Russians back into it, like on the space station. It would be messy. But luckily, the Mars trilogy is messy also.
What are your thoughts on the future of terraforming? Do you now with everything the way it is these days, do you think it's better that we focus more on Earth, or should we be focusing on other planets?
Well, on Earth, for sure. And luckily, terraforming serves as an excellent metaphor for geoengineering. So the exercise of reading the Mars trilogy, for instance, will make you aware that humans can tinker with the atmosphere. And at that point, since we're doing that here now, we're actively terraforming Earth. Now, Earth was already in a very human-friendly state, and so terraforming it has been in a bad way, but we can maybe terraform it in a good way and repair the damage we've done. So this is the only use for terraforming, which turns out to be highly impractical.
Do you consider yourself an optimist about terraforming, about our ability to actually make a long-term impact for the good?
On Earth, I do, yes. But I want to just say that this whole science fiction exercise of terraforming you know, other planets. A, we can only get to Mars and Venus in any practical sense. B, Earth is in terrible trouble, and could the ecosystem could crash in a way that would crash civilization with it. So the way to use science fiction right now is as a tool to imagine how to repair Earth's biosphere and make it a long-term space for human civilization to thrive in. That's the only use for science fiction right now.
Yeah. Well, that brings us up. That brings up the questions of governance and how you achieve consensus, and those are big topics. Why don't we wait till after the break to dive into
that?
Yeah,
I want to get into the economics as well. Yeah.
Great stuff so far.
Yeah. Well, what we like to do before we take a break, Stan, is we like to have what we call a quick fire round. Just short, punchy questions and answers so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. So here is the lightning round.
Okay.
What was the first science fiction you remember being exposed to?
Jules Verne.
Awesome. What technology has most changed humanity, do you think?
Whoa. Language.
Yeah, that's good. What is the best prediction an entrepreneur, a futurist, or a science fiction writer has ever made, in your opinion? Or forecast?
I'll say H.G. Wells constantly said there's going to need to be world government for humanity not to kill itself off. So we're in the midst of that.
Awesome. And the final one is, what science fiction story is most representative of the future you hope for?
That's a hard one. I'm scanning my brain. I like Ian Banks's Culture Future.
Yeah.
That's a joyful space and still filled with real problems. I like Le Guin, Left-Handed Darkness and the Dispossessed, struggling toward the good. And maybe I could just say my own ministry for the future, the next 30 years, best case scenario, getting through this next few decades without a mass extinction event caused by us, that would be utopia in the new definition.
Well, that was a phenomenal show. I don't know if you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It's just the first segment. We've got next week will be part two. But I do find some of the insights really interesting in terms of how he got into his career, that moment when he had to decide if he was going to pursue writing. And then the Viking missions, those stereopticon pictures that led to him thinking and looking down on Mars and saying he'd love to go hiking there, and that starting this incredible chain of events that led to the Mars trilogy. Another really great insight was in the research phase for the Mars trilogy, how Stan ended up working with Chris McKay, who's one of the world's leading planetologists and indeed the preeminent NASA expert on Mars terraforming. So there's real science behind the development of the Mars trilogy. Of course, we have learned more, as Stan points out during the interview, about the Martian environment since this trilogy was written. But at the time, there was very solid research behind the trilogy. Even Stan pointed out also that in the research phase for this, that he was researching throughout the entire 7 years that it took him to write the trilogy. And particularly, he noted that for the final book, Blue Mars, the final book in the series, he knew things, he had uncovered things in his research that he didn't know when he wrote the first book. And that's why some of that science developed during the trilogy also. And finally, in the final section before the break, we talked about terraforming, and obviously the Mars trilogy focuses a lot on terraforming Mars, but we ended up having a conversation about terraforming Earth and the need for us to geoengineer our way out of the problems we've created in the climate. We'll discuss that more in the second half, as well as getting into eco-economics and a bit of a plan for the climate. but a fantastic first segment of this special episode, Kim Stanley Robinson, the Minister for the Future. Provoked Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support the Futurist podcast. Provoked.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the Fintech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoked.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show.
Well, that's it for The Futurists this week. If you liked the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast for the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.